Welcome to another episode of Across the Pond, where we discuss the big stories and top investment ideas from the Eurozone and Switzerland. Events in the Middle East have been moving extremely fast. Markets have swung from fears of escalation to a very swift de-escalation with the announcement of a ceasefire. The key questions now are, will the ceasefire hold? Could this pave the way for lasting peace? And how quickly might the economy and supply chains return to normal? I'm Christopher Swan.
And I'm Belinda Peters. To unpack not just the global impact, but also the European angle and what all of this means for investors, we're joined once again by Paul Donovan, UBS's Global Chief Economist. Thanks for coming back, Paul.
Thanks for having me on.
So, yeah, maybe let's just start off with the latest developments. And I guess the big question is, you know, maybe to get your views on, can this ceasefire last? Are we heading for sort of an uneasy coexistence, perhaps a little bit similar to what we saw with the tariffs, where tensions cooled off but lingered somewhat?
Well, economically, the ceasefire hasn't held up very well. That is to say that as a result of Israeli strikes against Lebanon, Iran has said that it's closing the Strait of Hormuz again before more than three ships had managed to get their way through it. So what that is doing is, I think, really emphasizing the nature of the Iranian control, the new reality of Iran's position within the Gulf. And that is something which is new and is therefore likely to be a source of ongoing tension, not just with the United States, which may well withdraw from the region, but for the Gulf monarchies, for example, that are very dependent on the Strait of Hormuz to get goods in and out. So I think that the tension thing is absolutely going to be there. Does that escalate into a resumption of full-scale warfare? That, I think, is probably now a relatively low probability. And I think we will move to some kind of opening of the Strait of Hormuz as we look ahead. The reason for that, I think, is that from the US side, the domestic political environment is not particularly supportive of ongoing US hostilities. And Iran ultimately does want to reconstruct. And now that it has found a way of asserting more authority within the region, becoming a more significant regional player, I think it's going to be quite keen to go down that route. So I think you're right to characterize this as sort of ongoing background tensions, but perhaps somewhat different to what we've been seeing hitherto.
And obviously the headline-grabbing market move has been energy prices. So if we look at this market and assume the ceasefire holds and we don't have renewed strikes, in what ways do you see the market perhaps settling or normalizing on a global basis?
Well, it's going to be a new normal, I think. The Iranian government has signaled that it intends to charge a toll or a tariff, if you will, for ships passing through the Strait of Hormuz. That would work out at about a dollar a barrel for oil if the numbers that are being mooted turn out to be true. Economically, that's a rounding error. A dollar a barrel for Gulf originated oil is not going to be an economic game changer. Where you have got more problems in the near term is the damage to infrastructure in the region. This means that even when Iran chooses to reopen the Strait of Hormuz, you're not going to see oil trade resuming at a normal pace because it simply can't. You know, refineries and other plants have been damaged in strikes. Now, it's very difficult to assess exactly what has gone on because, you know, it's an ongoing situation. It's a war zone. You know, governments have been arresting people for taking photographs of damaged buildings with smartphones. So, I mean, you're in a situation where there's not a great deal of transparency. But I think it is safe to say that it is going to take several months before you would begin to see any kind of normalization of supply. And then when that happens, you still have to rebuild stockpiles, which have been used in the interim to sort of smooth out the problem. And so, again, you know, it's going to be quite some time, I think, before you get back to a more normalized oil market. We're talking certainly, you know, a year or so at the least, I would suggest.
So I guess one of the other major preoccupations over recent weeks has been the potential response of central banks. And obviously, some central banks came in for criticism, perhaps unfairly, after 2022 and the energy spike after Russia's invasion of Ukraine. What do you see now the outlook going forward for central bank policy? And I guess I'm thinking particularly about the Fed and the Bank of England.
So the central banks, I think, are going to pause for the time being. Now, the ECB was already on pause. Masterful inactivity is one of the few things the ECB does really well. So they were never going to be changing rates. They're already, I think, at a neutral policy rate, or that's how they would regard it. For the Fed and the Bank of England, this is a bit more interesting because those central banks at the start of this year were running repressive policies. That's to say that their policies were restrictive as far as growth was concerned. And in both cases, there was an expectation of rate cuts. Now, what the uncertainty surrounding the oil price has done is create a situation where I think both of those central banks are going to pause. Now, the Bank of England, I think, messed this up. That the Monetary Policy Committee meeting last month came out with quite an aggressive sounding statement. And the markets panicked and said, well, the Bank of England is going to raise rates. Now, that would be a really, really bad decision. And the markets overreacted. The bank was trying to talk tough and say, no, we're going to remain vigilant on inflation. And they ended up sounding like they were going to overreact. Central banks should not be raising rates on an oil price increase because there's nothing central banks can do about an oil price increase. You know, you're not going to get a consortium of central bankers in a rowboat in the Strait of Hormuz picking up mines. That's not going to work. So what central banks need to do is to look through the oil price and concentrate instead on the second round effects. If you see second round effects coming through, then you raise rates. If you don't get those second round effects on inflation, then you just ignore the oil price shock. You treat it like tariffs were treated. It's a one-off price shock. It's a tax, and it will fade from the inflation numbers after a year. So the Bank of England has now dialed back on the rhetoric. You know, Governor Bailey was sent out to go and talk to the media and say we messed up without saying we messed up. The Fed has also been quite clear, I think, in its communication in the last couple of weeks. The recent minutes from the March meeting, very, very balanced. And we've had both Fed President Williams, the New York Fed president and a very competent economist, and Fed Chair Powell both coming out and sort of signaling a calm reaction. So for now, nothing. If oil prices come down as the Strait of Hormuz reopens, not to where they were, but come sustainably below $100 a barrel, then I think in the second half of this year, both the Bank of England and the Fed will be reconsidering the policy of rate cuts, and we will be back to looking at a rate cut scenario in the latter part of this year.
And maybe just a quick follow-up. You spoke a lot about second-round effects of energy prices after the Russian invasion of Ukraine in 2022, in which companies used the shock as a pretext to raise prices. Do you expect to see this again this time around?
I think it's less likely. So second-round inflation effects really come in two forms. So the first is the classic 1970s-style wage price spiral. So prices up, people demand higher wages, which raise costs, which raise prices. That, I think, is very, very unlikely indeed. We just don't have the pay bargaining power. Labour markets have been not weak, but they're certainly, they've softened a little bit. And that is different from 2022. So one of the unusual, very unusual characteristics of 2022 was that there was a brief period of pay bargaining power in the aftermath of the pandemic. You know, everyone had a midlife crisis, quit their job and was churning around the labour market. And that actually raised pay bargaining power at that time. So I think it is unlikely, very, very unlikely we'd see a repeat of that. Now, a profit-led inflation episode where retailers in particular say, oh, well, we've got to raise prices Because of the oil shock, when in actual fact what they're doing is raising profit margin because of the opportunity. That is possible. I think it is less likely. There have been perhaps some slightly troubling signals from a couple of airlines in the States and perhaps elsewhere about, well, you know, we've got to pass on the fuel costs and maybe we don't take it back when fuel costs come down. So there may be some issues there. But I think what is different now is that there will be more price sensitivity on the part of consumers. It is going to be more difficult to get a price increase through sustainably. And so the profit-led inflation story, I think, is less likely. And with things like the affordability crisis in the States and with sensitivity to cost of living in Europe, politically, I think it will also be a lot more difficult to get away with.
Yeah, that's a good point to turn to Europe. Obviously, Europe was much harder hit by the Russia-Ukraine situation. And European countries, particularly Germany, I guess, had to sort of adapt quite considerably, becoming more resilient. I mean, perhaps you can give us an idea of how companies and governments have, how much progress they've made in diversifying supply chains, deploying greater efficiency, and what this means going forward.
Well, we have seen Europe adopt significant measures to improve efficiency and also, of course, to change energy supply. The rise of renewables has been very rapid. And the European economy or the UK economy today is really quite different from what it was even in 2022 in terms of energy dependency. Now, Germany did a great deal. What we saw in Germany in the manufacturing sector, so not the entire economy, but the manufacturing sector, was about a 25% efficiency gain in terms of energy consumption. And that came about through just basic efficiency measures. It came about through closing down very, very energy intensive areas of production, which were, you know, outdated and so on and so forth. And it wasn't necessarily restructuring supply chains in the sense of moving these things offshore, though that has happened in a few cases. It was more about just saying, actually, you know what, this is too old, we need to get rid of it. And now let's look at new, modern, more efficient equipment. And so we've seen those changes come through. The rise of renewables has also been very significant. So in Spain, you know, there are times when Spain is literally giving electricity away because the renewable energy power creation is so significant. In the UK, it's now fairly frequent that over half of electricity supply is being generated by renewable energy. In the UK, it's primarily wind plus some solar. So you're already seeing this evolution come through. Now, that's not enough to offset the loss of 13-15% of global oil supply coming through the Gulf, but it is a partial offset to that. It's limiting some of the damage, and it's something that we're going to see continue. I think what this crisis has done is again give an impetus to continue investing in renewables, continuing looking at efficiency. I think personally, we will probably see significant investment in battery storage, which 15 years ago wasn't terribly efficient. So if you put some solar panels on the roof of your house 15 years ago, you didn't put in place a battery. Now the batteries are a great deal more effective. People are more likely to retrofit those. And again, you change the patterns of energy generation and how it's consumed.
So focusing a little on the cyclical side of the Eurozone economy and the European economy more broadly, we had an overweight, an attractive rating on Eurozone equities, partly due to a sort of more positive cyclical outlook. Where are we now? How is the outlook for Europe looking?
Well, for the very short term, actually not that much has changed. Because what we are going to see in the short term is consumers manage the higher oil price, not by cutting back on consumption, I think that's generally unlikely, but by easing back on how much they save on a monthly basis. So that will lead to some moderation in terms of the savings rate, which will then translate through into more or less stability in terms of consumption. Certainly when we look at the data that's coming through so far, there aren't signs of sort of any immediate panic on the part of consumers. And that's quite likely. Now, that can't carry on indefinitely. At some point, consumers are going to say, well, we can't keep cutting back on the savings rate. We're going to have to start, you know, trimming some of our consumer spending. And there are already, you know, measures towards efficiency, things like working from home, which is not only economically efficient, it's also efficient in terms of energy use. So you're seeing things like that already starting to creep in, which enables the consumer to carry on for a little bit longer, but it does change some of the patterns. As we look ahead, though, in terms just of production, there is going to be some constraint that comes through because you are going to see rising prices, for example, for airfares. And that will affect the tourism sector, which is significant in parts of Europe. You will see things like rising energy costs impacting areas of the manufacturing sector. It may well have become more efficient. We may well have more renewables, but there is still an impact there. And that is going to be a constraint. So the longer that this goes on, the more negative impulse that you are likely to get coming into the system. And then there's some other factors that we have to consider when we look a little bit beyond the immediate impact. So if we are going to be seeing consumers shifting some of their behavior, well, you know, the solar panels and the electric vehicles come from China. And you know, you're going to be substituting imported goods for domestic goods in that sense. You don't want to buy, a German-made petrol-driven car. You're going to buy a Chinese-made electric vehicle, hypothetically. So that sort of thing is also something which might weigh on domestic economic activity a little bit towards the end of the year. So it's a drag. I mean, you know, this is a significant shock. It's a major event, and it is going to be a drag on economic activity. But the consumer has a degree of resilience in the short term.
And as with the war in Ukraine, hasn't this conflict underlined some of these broader global trends? For example, reshoring, friendshoring, electrification, and perhaps energy independence. How do you think these trends could play out in Europe, and could they be particularly beneficial for the industrial sector?
The electrification story, which was already a very strong story, is just further boosted by this. Absolutely. I think that that is certainly the case. And some of the shifts towards not necessarily complete energy independence, but to certainly a greater awareness of the importance of not being overly reliant on imported energy. That is also, I think, going to be part of the process. The onshoring story is a bit more complex. Because I think one of the considerations there is going to be the energy input cost. So you know, you've got to weigh up potential disruption to supply chains as an encouragement for onshoring versus, well, is my electricity more expensive than electricity in Norway, for example, and the power cost difference or the power risks that come through from that are going to be something that plays into this particular issue. And I think that will become important in terms of locating certain more energy intensive sectors. You know, you are going to locate energy intensive sectors where you are going to be able to get a reliable, cheap and probably renewable source of energy coming through. So that might be Spain, rather than, you know, locating to Germany. You think, well, actually, we'll put this plant in Spain because the solar panel, solar power issue there is a lot more positive. So it's a complex process, but the longer term trends, I think, are generally being reinforced by the shock that we're seeing at the moment. And of course, it's worthwhile remembering with a lot of these shifts, it's what economists call a ratchet effect, that, you know, the shock of higher oil prices causes people to change, causes people to switch to renewables and so on and so forth. But then when the oil price comes down, they don't switch back again. You know, I'm not going to rip the solar panels off the roof of my house if oil goes to $50 a barrel. You know, I've put them in place and there they're going to stay for, you know, the foreseeable future. So that sort of change is a more structural shift, which I think is just being accelerated by the current situation.
And then looking ahead, if we do see greater certainty of peace in the Middle East, particularly in the Gulf region, and discussions shift to reconstruction and rearmament, do you see European and Asian companies benefiting most from this? And maybe you can talk about the broader implications, such as the dollar's role and its status as a reserve currency.
So this is the big question. That we know it is going to require quite a lot of money to reconstruct. As I said earlier, we're not entirely sure of the full extent of the damage because, you know, if you try and take a picture in Dubai, you'll find yourself being hauled off by the police. So there are limits to our understanding of just how much reconstruction has to take place. But of course, there is going to have to be reconstruction, and that will be funded out of oil revenue. It may also be funded out of the sovereign wealth funds. Because we've got to remember that, you know, effectively the Gulf monarchies have not had revenue coming in from oil. They've not been able to sell any oil or relatively constrained amounts of oil. And so there's a fiscal shortfall that's coming through. So they may have to dip into, as it were, their savings account, which is what the sovereign wealth funds effectively operate as. So the question then is, particularly, I think, with the rearmament and the building up of defense systems, where are you going to spend the money? Traditionally, the Gulf states have spent on American military technology for the most part. I mean, they do buy from Europe as well, but it's been skewed towards the United States. That, I think, is something that may be called into question. The role of the United States in the region, the failure of US forces to play a particularly strong role in defending Gulf monarchies from missile attacks and drone attacks, the fact that the war started at all. You know, these are things which have, I think, created a bit of division. And what we saw with Europe, of course, in the aftermath of threats to Greenland, was Europe has pivoted and is reducing its defense procurement in the United States and instead doing more defense procurement at home and in Asia. So if that then happens, what you will end up with, I think, is potentially two problems for the dollar. The first is that the sovereign wealth funds are skewed towards dollar assets. And so if they are dipping into the sovereign wealth funds to pay for the reconstruction and rearmament, that's going to involve selling US dollar denominated assets. And secondly, the money that is received from petrodollars or received from the sale of assets from sovereign wealth funds is then being directed primarily towards Europe and towards Asia. And that then reduces another source of demand for dollars. Now, I don't think this is a dollar crash, but I do think it is something which means the dollar is likely to continue to drift downwards in the wake of the conflict. Does it destroy the dollar's reserve status? No. The dollar, I think, will remain the largest reserve currency. But we've already been seeing the dollar's market share as a central bank reserve has been in decline in the last few years. And I think that decline will continue as we look ahead.
Great. Thanks, Paul. And thanks to our listeners as well. We unfortunately don't have any more time for questions. We can delve into specific securities on these podcasts, but you can explore some of these with your UBS representative. And we also very much recommend our Equity Compass, which goes into full detail about where we see the most value. But just to sum up here, the two-week ceasefire in the Middle East is a positive development, but various issues remain unresolved, with the fragility of the agreement dampening optimism. We believe investors should position for medium-term equity upside while diversifying portfolios with quality bonds, gold, and broad commodities. We'll be back soon with another installment of Across the Pond. In the meantime, have a great week.
UBS Chief Investment Office's investment views are prepared and published by the Global Wealth Management Business of UBS AG or its affiliate, UBS. This material has no regard to the specific investment objectives, financial situation, or particular needs of any specific recipient and is published for informational purposes only. As a firm providing wealth management services to clients globally, UBS AG and its subsidiaries offer both investment advisory services and brokerage services. Investment advisory services and brokerage services are separate and distinct, differ in material ways, and are governed by different laws and separate arrangements. In the USA, UBS Financial Services, Inc. is a subsidiary of UBS AG and a member of FINRA SIPC. For information, please visit our website at ubs.com/workingwithus. For a full legal disclaimer applicable to the independent investment views produced by UBS, please visit our website at ubs.com/CIO-disclaimer.